From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are but a handful of times in the history of our country, writes Doris Kearns Goodwin in her latest big book, when there occurs a transformation so remarkable that a molt seems to take place and an altered country begins to emerge. Many Americans of many perspectives seem to long for something like that right now. What makes it happen? This hour, On Point historian Doris Kearns Goodwin on Teddy Roosevelt, the bully pulpit, and change in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know the story of Teddy Roosevelt, his frenemy Taft, the muckrakers, the bully pulpit, TR's progressive push? Is the country ready today for that kind, that scale of change? How would it happen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome to our newest listeners today on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore, Maryland. We are glad to have you with us. Joining me now in the studio is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She wrote the book Team of Rivals that became Steven Spielberg's big movie, Lincoln. One of the country's most celebrated interpreters of American history. Her big new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome back to On Point.
I am so glad to be with you.
It's great to have you right here on the day before Thanksgiving. We want to kind of step back with you. What a great person to step back and take a big picture look at where we are, where we've been. But let's bring TR right in here with us. Amazingly, he came along just in time to have a little of his voice on tape, and we have some right here. Is Teddy Roosevelt. This is a speech, The Farmer and the Businessman. This is August 1912. He talks about the inequality of his era. Teddy Roosevelt.
The present conditions of business cannot be accepted as satisfactory. There are too many who do not prosper enough. And of the few who prosper greatly, there are certainly some whose prosperity does not mean well for the country.
And here he was in 1913, talking about the square deal.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in matters social and industrial.
And there he is. It's just amazing to have that voice in our ears. You've written in such wonderful depth about Teddy and so much around him in this book. How do you picture him? As we hear those that voice in our ears, Doris.
It's really moving to hear that voice again right now because, you know, for all the other people, when I write about Lincoln, you know nothing except what somebody says about a high-pitched voice.
Yeah.
So I'm just sort of a little overwhelmed just to have started listening to that. The most important thing that Teddy Roosevelt understood was that between the Civil War and 1900, a Gilded Age had developed from the industrial era, where there was this huge gap between the rich and the poor, where monopolies were swallowing up small businesses, where people were not being taken care of in the workplace. And he had to establish for the country that government was the agency to help right some of those wrongs and to help bring about more equality in the country. And there was no belief at the time that government should have any role in the social and economic life of the country. Laissez-faire was like a religious conviction. So when he speaks, as he just did now, about fairness and the square deal, it was perfectly positioned to reach the center of the country because he's saying, I'm not going to go against the rich just because they're rich, only if they use unfair means. I'm not going to go against the poor only if they don't use their opportunities. The rock of class hatred is the rock on which we will found. And he just insisted that we had to take care of the people in society. And that was a huge change from the attitudes from the Civil War up till 1900.
I mean, he writes, you quote him, you're saying, if we attack unjustly the property rights of others because they are wealthy, we shall do ourselves just as much damage as if we are permitted to an attack upon those who are poor because they are poor. He called it in both directions, but the progressive movement is well known for going after that Gilded Age and trying to bring some more equality, some more humanity. You make clear here that as strong as he was at the bully pulpit, and I want to talk about how he used that, that he was by no means alone there. This was not a solo act that brought about this great age of molt and change.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that happens when we get these periods of movements is that it means that there's a lot of different parts of society that are participating in it. It's never just the president. And in his case, he used the bully pulpit. He had a great idea of how to shorthand language so people would hear him. The square deal, as I say, perfectly positioned. But he needed a group of progressive journalists who had a bully pulpit of their own. He needed churches. He needed the academies, the universities. And it was almost like an uprising of the society saying, we have to do something to make things better for the people in the tenements, people in the slums, people in the factories. That's why I think it would be such an exciting era in which to live. I'd love to go back then.
Last week, we were observing the 50th anniversary of the death of John F. Kennedy. And of course, he at 43 was the youngest person ever elected president. Teddy Roosevelt at 42, the youngest president, because he came also through assassination from the vice presidency here. Did he have any idea when he stepped into office, did he articulate that the country was ready for some very large change?
He knew it, but he knew he had to move step by step. I mean, he had been, as governor, a reform governor in New York before he became president. And in fact, the political bosses were so upset by some of the reform legislation that he passed to rein in business and to regulate parts of the state economy that they stuck him in the vice presidency, thought, okay, that's where he'll end up, because the vice presidency was not a channel for the presidency then. Mm-hmm. So when McKinley was killed, the political bosses thought, oh my God, as one of them said, that damn cowboy is now president. What are we going to do?
When they said cowboy, they meant partly just that was part of his public image, the guy on the bucking bronco. What did they mean politically?
What they meant was that they weren't sure he would follow their rules and that he would let business control political activities. In most states, if the senators were chosen by state legislatures, mm-hmm. you could buy a Senate seat for $1 million, and it was done. So that business really felt that they were in the sway. They had control of the country in a way. So the big thing Roosevelt is doing is saying, I represent the people. My presidency is a steward of the people. Government's going to control the country, and not control the country, but set the rules by which the private enterprise is going to deal.
What are the parallels you see between that time and now? What's similar in the tensions that the country was experiencing, and what's unique to that time?
Well, I think what's happened, I mean, sometimes people tease me, how do your book somehow manage to come back to an earlier time and resemble it? And I tease that it just takes me so long that history cycles back. But I think there really is a reason for the similarity now, which is just as the Industrial Revolution created that gap between rich and poor and left the ordinary people struggling, so the Digital Revolution has done the same. Billionaires rising mm-hmm. up, huge companies merging and acquisitioning, if that's a word. Mm-hmm. And ordinary people feeling squeezed and the middle class feeling squeezed. After World War II, with full employment during World War II, unions being strong and an income tax having been set in, we had 25 years of a strong middle class. And then since the 80s, 90s, and now particularly in this new century, the middle class is being hurt in part. Unions have diminished in power. People resent what government does. It doesn't have the strength that it did in belief before. It's reduced itself in certain areas from our lives. And we are similarly feeling, some people think, a new Gilded Age, but without the progressive movement to satisfy the problems.
There's a lot of talk about change, and not only from the left, the progressive movement. The Tea Party might well see itself as the molt that's coming or that's needed. But somehow the idea of a man at a bully pulpit, even a man on horseback, even a cowboy, you look back and you think, how did he do that? I mean, even if you've never heard his voice, we've seen him on the back of the train, those big choppers going and his fist waving and he's talking. But that's one little, you know, back of the train crowd at a time. How did he use the bully pulpit to make such major transformation?
Well, the reason he was able, I think, to make those transformations was not simply that he went out on the train, which is, you're absolutely right. He was outside of Washington more than any president before him. He would go across the country on these whistle-stop tours. And he really wanted to connect to people. I mean, he did. He knew emotionally how to speak, he said, in shorthand language that his Harvard buddies would think was homely and folksy. He had all these slogans, speak softly and carry a big stick, you know, good to the very last drop. He gave it to Maxwell House.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, he was.
Was he talking coffee or whiskey?
He was talking coffee. Some people think that he drank a lot of cup of coffees a day. He had such energy. But more importantly, he made a productive set of relationships with the press. Normally, the press and a president are feeling tension with each other. Mm-hmm. And they still did during his time. But he understood that he needed their megaphone as well as his own. And as long as he gave them the integrity to criticize him, which they continued to do, and then he could argue with them about their remedies, they then created the stories, the exposés that he was able to use in his speeches that made what Standard Oil was doing from Ida Tarbell come alive, Lincoln Steffen showing up the political corruption in the cities. It wasn't just abstract, his stories and his speeches. He could draw on their research, which was incredible, their research. It still stands up today.
And yet, we have the press has suffered in many ways, but we still have a large press, no doubt larger, way larger in total than we had then. We have a president who, right now, who's, known as no mean speaker. Certainly it brought him to the White House on the strength of his using that bully pulpit, or his rhetoric anyway. And somehow the chemistry's not the same.
I think two things have happened. One is that the bully pulpit itself has been diminished. I mean, think about it. When Roosevelt gave one of those speeches, the whole speech would be printed in the newspaper. Everyone would be talking about it. There wasn't that many distractions at that time. Even through FDR's time, when he gave those radio addresses, Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night, not miss a word of what he was saying. Everybody was in their kitchen or their living room listening. Even in the early days of television, JFK to Reagan, the whole speech would be on the television three networks. Now you might listen to your own cable network, and you might hear the pundits criticizing the speech before it's barely begun. Do we have the attention span? Even if we get connected to a problem that a president raises, some new breaking news occurs 3 days later, and we lose our focus. So that's one of the problems. The other is that what made the press, especially the characters at McClure's magazine, these legendary journalists I wrote about, able to have such an impact is the founder gave them 2 years to do their research, so that they were producing mini histories that still last today before they had to write a word.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive era, and when and how America transforms. Her big new book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. There's an excerpt at our website. Of course, she's written about Abraham Lincoln. She's written about FDR, Lyndon Johnson, one of the country's most celebrated interpreters of history. This time, it's T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, that she brings to life. Here he is. And we're lucky to have recordings that go all the way back. Talk about the bully pulpit. You can still hear it. This is August 1912. Teddy Roosevelt speaking, saying government cannot make people successful. It can't make people prosper, but it can set the table for broad success. Here's Teddy Roosevelt himself.
Rational progressives, no matter how radical, are well aware that nothing the government can do will make some men prosper. And we heartily approve the prosperity, no matter how great, of any man if it comes as an incident to rendering service to the community. But we wish to shape conditions so that a greater number of the small men in business, the decent, respectable, industrious, and energetic men who conduct small businesses, who are retail traders, who run small stores and shops, shall be able to succeed.
That voice cuts right through. And here we are, a century, 101 years later. Doris Kearns Goodwin is in the studio with us. And still, there it is, that voice. When did he know it was working? When did he know that the country was responding to his kind of battle cry?
He could feel it when he went out on those train trips. There's no question. People would arrive at the village stations loading him up with these bizarre gifts, lizards, horned toads, bears. And they followed him, even the cartoonists, when he watched the kind of fun that the cartoonists made of him with his big pulpit and his glasses and his teeth. He knew how good-natured the ribbing was. So he had somehow entered into the emotional hearts of the people in a way that, Lincoln was beloved after he died and beloved at the end of the war. But it is said that no president probably had connected as emotionally to people as he had, and he felt it.
And yet, it wasn't just a connection. It was a link that would lead. Just describe some of the things that he brought, the changes that he made.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, the antitrust legislation broke up Standard Oil, U.S. Steel, a very series of monopolies, so allowing small business to have some greater chance. And then workmen's compensation. All these laws on working conditions had never been approved before. And women and exploitation of children in the factory. Conservation. All that public land that
limits
was owned
on the
by
working
private
day, protecting consumers from unsafe food and drugs, on and on.
Meatpacking plants. plants that had diseased foods, fake medicines that were on the market. So all of those things were the first regulation of private enterprise, which wasn't dealing fairly. And that's always in the excerpts that you use. He's not saying we just want it there for its own sake. All we want is a fair playing ground for people. And that's what hit the country, I think.
So, I mean, very similar language has been used in very recent years. And yet we look around at a status quo that seems kind of frozen right now. Did it seem so frozen then, or was there a sense of larger flux as he took the stage, like, oh, things are moving?
Well, interestingly, the Congress itself was kind of frozen when he first got there because the majority Republicans were the old guard, mm-hmm. and they were in league with the business community and the political bosses. They wanted nothing to do with him. But when he mobilized the public to put pressure on them from the outside in, that's when they began to feel, we can't bottle these things up in committee. They have to get to the floor. Once they got to the floor, they had to vote on them because they were popular.
Do you feel anything like that sense of flux or potential change, right or left, today, Doris?
I do. I mean, I think the country itself is mobilized to want change. I mean, you hear 80% of the people unhappy with what's going on in Washington. And Washington has cordoned itself off from the popular will, in part because of the redistricting situation, which has to be dealt with, in large part because of the money, the amount of time it takes the congressmen and senators to raise the funds that they're needed, which means the special interests have control. Somehow, campaign finance and the money is still the poison in the system, much more than it was back in 1906. I mean, in 1906, Teddy passed a law that prevented corporations from giving money to political campaigns. That's what was overturned in Citizens United.
That's unbelievable.
So, incredibly, right?
I mean, the Tillman Act of 1907 would come out of that. And I'm reading here from Roosevelt in his annual address to Congress in 1905, saying all contributions by corporations to any political committee for any political purpose should be forbidden by law. That is much more than 100 years ago.
Right. And now we've overturned that. So I think somehow the public has to figure out, how are we going to exert our will? And you're right, it's either on the left or the right, but Congress is not listening to anybody. It seems like they've been caught. You know, it used to be 50 years ago that the political culture was so different. It's not just the people that were there, but the Democrats and Republicans stayed on the weekends. They played poker together.
Capitol Hill,
they didn't run home to raise money. Mm-hmm. They formed friendships across party lines. LBJ could never have gotten the civil rights filibuster broken without Dirksen, the Republican leader, who was his friend. Mm-hmm. And they had, many of them had been in World War II together, so they knew what it was like to have a common mission, which was more important than where you came from. That is all lost now. And they're connected to their little district in the House, which doesn't care about moderation in the country. It's extreme on one side or another. And they're connected to the people who are giving them the money, which is what keeps them in the campaign funds. We have to break that cycle somehow.
But you say 80% expressing unhappiness, Congress down in the single digits. I mean, there's different kinds of, dynamic unhappiness, and then there's a sullen, still unhappiness. It seems a little bit to me in the latter category these days.
That's a very good point, because I think that's right. There was a turbulence during the progressive era that could have gone in different directions. There was a lot of violence in the strikes in the cities. There was mm-hmm. a lot of socialism out there. Mm-hmm. And that actually helped Teddy Roosevelt, because he could then say, if we don't do this rational centrist action, here are these socialists wanting to take over the businesses, mm-hmm. take over the utilities.
You think I'm scary? Look at that.
Right. Exactly. So it wasn't sullen. It was an anger that could have been channeled negatively. He channeled it positively. But now you have a feeling that people are just much more passive about what can we do.
What about the press piece of this? You point with great admiration at the McClure's magazine and Ida Tarbell and all those writers who turned out these incredible stories. And I look around today and you think about the scandals that are out there. It's not as if they're not covered. Look at the environment. There are reams written on what's going on with the environment. Look at Wall Street. I mean, it may not satisfy everyone, but there has been so much written about all the hanky-panky and shady stuff that's gone on. What was the difference? Was it in the journalism itself or the population reading it that made it so such a kind of a lit fuse in those days?
I think it is the population reading it. I mean, clearly, I think the quality journalism is still there now. I think there is that desire on young journalists to have a mission and a call, which is what the McClure's people felt. They really felt they were a power for good. And even later in their lives, when this period ended, they looked back on it with the nostalgia, knowing we really did something. Mm. But when those magazines would be published, only 400,000 people are reading them initially. But
of course,
then
that's out of a much smaller population.
And also, then they give them to everybody
yes.
else. They create columns in the newspaper. They create newspaper stories. And it became the topic of conversation. Just think about how distracted we are today. Even if we pay attention to one of these exposés that comes out. Before you know it, something else is taken up. We're doing Facebook. We're doing blogs. The same journalists who are producing these great things have a lot of other responsibilities. They're on television. But on the other hand, the new means of communications, which allows you to have things online without print that is less expensive perhaps to do, should allow us, if we use that new media, to make a difference again.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's big new book on the progressive era, Teddy Roosevelt, Taft, the journalism of the time, muckraking is the bully pulpit. Let's turn to our listeners. Bill in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling to say that I'm very excited about this new book. I think it's wonderful. I loved her book, The Team of Rivals, and I'm looking forward to this. I've immersed myself in this time that we're talking about, and I've been reading, because I don't have this book yet, a book by the historian Barbara Tuchman called The Proud Tower that also addressed this time before the war and the upheaval in the whole world. I mean, you had socialists and anarchists at this time because, as Doris said, you know, we had, you know, 18-hour, 16-hour days and children working and so on. I do think we're kind of in that time again. And I think there is an attempt by the 1% to try to bring us somewhat back to that time. And I think it's, just, you know, a horrible possibility. And I just hope that we can get to the point where the passive allowing it to happen passes. I think that we're absolutely right. There are more people voting for Democrats as a whole for the Congress, but because of gerrymandering, it's not possible. I just want to make one other comment about Citizens Bank. I have a much simpler definition of a citizen than the Supreme Court came up with. To me, if it can't vote, it's not a citizen. And I'll end on that point.
Citizens United there and the Supreme Court decision. Bill, point taken. I mean, there again, the idea that maybe the country's pregnant with change, but maybe not. And in which direction? Was it clear in 1902 that if there was going to be change, it would be change toward the progressive or the left at that time?
I think it was clear that Roosevelt was moving slightly toward the left, but he did move step by step, and not until after his election in 04 on his own right did he really introduce the more serious regulation program, because he needed that legitimacy of having had his own election. You know, but your caller is right. I mean, Barbara Tuchman understood that this wasn't only happening in America, and I'm not a world historian, but it's true it was happening in a lot of other countries, and so too is our problems in a lot of other countries. I mean, just reading about the Pope now talking about inequality and the importance of allowing people to have an opportunity in so many other countries of the world, it's right on target today as one of the major problems. The reason inequality is such a problem is that it means that people are not feeling that they have mobility going up the ladder. And if you don't have a chance through the educational system or the way the structure of society is to have your talents realized, then society is losing out, not just those people, but society is losing these people who could be doing something so worthwhile and their lives cut short as a result.
Let's go to Aaron in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Aaron, you're on the air with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mrs. Goodwin, the casting for Steven Spielberg's film based on your Lincoln book was brilliant. Now that he will also be directing the film based on your new book, can you give us some insight to who is being considered to play this
story? Aaron, thank you. Has it been optioned by Spielberg,
yes,
this
Spielberg's
one as well?
Yes, actually, yes. What happened is when we were working on the Lincoln book, he talked to me about Teddy Roosevelt and Taft, and he read the manuscript, read the page proofs, read the book, and he has optioned it now for a movie as well.
He's a pretty good reader of American sentiment. What's going to fly, what's not? I mean, all the way along. Does that mean that Steven Spielberg thinks, I mean, the Civil War, we know there's perpetual interest in that and large interest from all quarters. Does he really think that the Americans have the kind of interest to go in and think about muckrakers and the eight-hour day?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it could be one of two things. If it's a movie, it could be a movie or a miniseries. They haven't decided yet which. They'll decide that after a short period. If it's a miniseries, then the muckrakers are all there. If it's a movie, then it's the relationship between Teddy and Taft, which itself is an emotional relationship, which could have been set in another time even without the muckrakers.
Kind Here of a, with these a two, buddy film.
These two great friends who, you know, who Teddy really handpicks him as his successor, and then they break apart in 1912 to heartbreak for both. So, you know, and then we try to figure out, he's right, who would be who. And everybody says, of course, John Goodman for Taft. And
Taft was 300 and how many pounds?
Maybe yes. Philip Seymour Hoffman for Teddy. Although I keep teasing that Daniel Day-Lewis, who has become my good friend and who is so amazing, did such an incredible job as Lincoln. If he could raise himself 100 pounds, he could be Teddy, and 150, maybe he could be Taft.
Remind us what split these two men who had been such close friends and co-conspirators, in a way, in a positive sense, in their political impulses.
Well, what just happened, in short, is they had started becoming friends when they were in their early 30s in Washington. Civil Service Commissioner Teddy was, Solicitor General Taft was, and they were both young reformers. Even then, they wanted to do something about the corruption of the age. And they stayed friends throughout as Taft went to the Philippines as Governor General. Teddy went to New York State as governor. And then he brought Taft back as his Secretary of War, but most importantly, as his single advisor. When he was away on those train trips all the time, Taft was the acting president. He handpicked
him. Even though he was not vice president.
Not the vice president, not the Secretary of State. I mean, it was interesting. In fact, he said, somebody said, what's going to happen when you're away? He said, don't worry, Taft is sitting on the lid.
And
then, of course,
Big
Taft
was
sitting on the lid. But then what happened is he makes him president. He runs his campaign. He's so happy when he wins. He goes to Africa for a year to give him space.
This is Teddy goes to Africa after his two terms.
After his two terms are up.
He successfully got Taft in the White House.
He knows everything's going to be all right. My legacy is fine. He goes to Africa, comes back, and his progressive friends tell him that Taft had sort of moved toward the old guard in the Congress. He tried to get legislation through, as Teddy did. He actually got it through, but compromised too much, according to the progressives. And I think Teddy just wanted to be back in office again, so he ends up running against his great friend, brutal campaign in 1912. And they both split, of course, the Republican vote as Teddy forms a third party and the Democrat Woodrow Wilson wins.
Here's the voice of Teddy Roosevelt. This is Carnegie Hall, March 12, 1912, when he was challenging Taft for the Republican nomination. That didn't work out. He became the Bull Moose. But here's Teddy in that effort.
I prefer to work with moderates, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward towards the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them. We, the people, cannot turn back. Our aim must be steady, wise progress.
When conservatives sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them. Incredible to hear that.
Oh, his language was so fiery. And, you know, and then the crowd would be coming back at him, too, which we may not be hearing. Hit him again, Teddy. No. Hit him again. Harder. It was a real, like a boxing match almost, that he engendered among the people once he got out there on the trail.
As I read this, I wondered about Americans themselves. Sort of, it's impossible to look at large, and yet we do in a way. And there are moral fiber or moral sensitivity at the time. And I just found myself wondering if it was higher. If, you know, we hear about injustices or we hear about inequities and we take them on board and we turn to our latest app or something. Were people tuned higher morally in those days, in your sense of it?
Wow, you know, I hadn't thought about that, Tom, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, think about it. These people, their parents had been part of the Civil War generation, so they felt that that generation had righted a terrible wrong. And they were proud of all those people, their parents who'd been in that war or lived through that war.
The sacrifice, the mission.
And now they had begun to feel, I think, not just Teddy, but the people as a whole, this is our generation's responsibility. And in fact, Ray Baker, one of the muckrakers, talked to his father. He said, I may not be doing it with blood, what you did in the Civil War, but we are using pen and ink to right the wrongs that we now feel have been created by the industrial era. And I think they believed a stunning sense that if this country is this republic that we founded, so special, opportunity being the core of what we believed in, and it's not providing that anymore, that it's not moral. And Teddy, the reason he used the word bully pulpit was bully meant splendid then. Mm-hmm. It didn't mean what it means now.
Bully chap.
But bully meant pulpit meant I want to morally educate the country and lift their standards. And I think it's true that people felt really concerned about the fact that we weren't living up to our ancient ideals, and they were ready for this kind of a movement. And I hadn't thought about that before till you said it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the celebrated historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about Teddy Roosevelt, the Progressive Era, and when and how America transforms. She's written it all up in The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, she wrote Team of Rivals. It became Steven Spielberg's big movie, Lincoln. Option again on this one. We'll see how that rolls out. I mean, these days, bully pulpits all over the place, and they are harsh. They are tough. Here's Fox News just a couple of days ago. Kimberly Guilford saying President Obama was the most destructive president ever.
It just really begs the question, is it the worst president ever? Well, he's certainly the most destructive president we've had in terms of tearing apart this country and all of the freedoms that we have fought for. He hasn't been able to make government programs work.
Billy pulpits, bully pulpits and pundits right and left, not just from the right. Here's Dylan Radigan on MSNBC talking about the Tea Party. He's tough.
The Tea Party has a bit of an integrity problem, as everybody from birthers to open racists to outright Nazis are actually on the team. And no one involved, including its leadership, seems to mind that fact.
Rage, outrage, faux rage all over the place. Does it dilute the real sensibility of the nation?
One of those two voices are actually describing what the problems of the country are or what the possible remedies are. They're just taking after one another. And that, I think, was the difference in what these journalists did at the turn of the 20th century. They produced these long 50,000-word pieces that were so heavily researched that they told a story, but they are still invaluable today. And at least there was an agreement on the facts. There could be argument then about what should we do about the problem of Standard Oil mopping up so many businesses or the problems of railroads not being fair or the meatpacking plants. But at least the country said, yes, this is a problem. And then we now, but we don't even agree on what our problems are. That's a real problem. And I think part of it, too, is that there is a pace of life today. The interesting thing, at the turn of the 20th century, they worried that there was a lot of nervous disorders because the pace of life had sped up so much. You know, that
100 years ago.
Telegrams replacing handwritten letters and people moving from the country with the nice solace of nature to the city and local horrors being spread out in these tabloid press. Think of it today. I mean, the pace of life is such an extreme that I think to really focus on our role as what we are as citizens is very hard unless we get mobilized ourselves to do so.
Here's a question from one of our listeners. It says, as TR was gaining power, Civil War vets would have been near the max of their own political power. They would have been very young men when they went to war, if they were still around, kind of, you know, maybe wielding a big stick, to use a phrase. He asks, what was the effect of the Civil War vet lobby, if there was one? Was there?
Well, yes, they did get pensions that were considered sometimes to be more than they should have gotten, but still they had that effect. But I think more importantly, ideologically, a little bit of what we were saying, that having those people still around for whom there was such a sense of pride in what had been done in finally undoing the curse of slavery meant that this generation wanted to do its own thing.
Do its own thing, meaning tackle the problems that Teddy Roosevelt was laying before them.
Exactly so.
When these muckrakers laid out all the horrors that they described, was it really news to people, or was there something about the moral framing of it that made it exciting?
Yeah, it had become news in local newspapers up till then, but the difference was that in the national magazines, they wrote it as a story and framed it in a much more serious way than just the discovery of something happening in a local newspaper. And it hit the country as a whole in these national newspapers, and they knew how to write stories.
What would be the equivalent of that kind of revelation and its weight today? Can you picture? Well, you know, what would it be? Would it be a big book like yours? Would it be a 10-page series in a newspaper? Would it be, I don't know, some kind of multi-platform? What might be as exciting today in terms of revelatory reportage compared to that?
I don't know. I wish I knew. I mean, I think it probably would have to be multi-platform. I'm not sure there's any one platform that could do it nowadays, since we watch so many different things, we read so many different things. But it would mean young journalists coming out of their schools with that sense, again, of a mission and a call, and young politicians deciding to enter public life. I worry that when they look at what's happening in Washington now, would a young person really say, oh, I can't wait to be one of those guys. I can't wait. I mean, it used to be that they could be proud, like in the 60s. They knew they'd passed the civil rights law. They desegregated the South, the voting rights law.
Yeah.
They could tell their children, I was there. What can they do now? So unless we make some break in this, our politicians will be of lesser note, and maybe the journalists won't have that same sense of moral outrage that they once had.
I mean, I read it both ways. I have a lot of young people in my sphere, and I have heard them say, we are frightened about the future. And I've heard them say, we must change it. This isn't a joke. You know, the rubber is meeting the road here. Jerry in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you're on with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm listening to your show, and two things come through ringingly clear. One has to do with money, the other has to do with education, and the other has to do with the passion for learning. I think, you know, given what's happened with our media, the consolidation of the media and the rise of social networks, I think that folks today versus when I grew up have lost the passion for reading, the written word, and for thinking through the issues. I think folks today are too interested in the soundbite, and they form their opinions around the soundbite rather than researching and going through an intellectually rigorous exercise and determining the issues. I think this has to do also with the level of education and the consolidation of the media. And behind this is, of course, money. And I think, you know, when you see major magazines and newspapers go out of business because they're being consolidated by the consolidators, such as Rupert Murdoch, and when we see the divisiveness on education, which is, of course, determined by ad valorem taxes and, you know, where your kids go to school, I think this all plays into the sort of dumbing down of America, and we're getting what basically we're paying for, which is poor education, faulty media, and the lack of critical thinking.
And maybe a politics that come with it. Jerry, let us pick it up right there. Thank you so much for your call, Doris. How about it? I mean, it's interesting. We know this critique, but I'm thinking at the same time, turn of the last century, many people didn't go very far in school at all. I don't even know what the literacy rate in this country was in those days. Sound bites? Well, square deal is a sound bite. But still, there's some. You can't help but listen to Jerry and think, yes, what are you thinking as he lays that out?
You know, in the end, I mean, I agree with him, almost everything he said, but FDR once said, problems created by men can be solved by men. Unless we have the feeling of the possibility of changing where we are, then we really will get nowhere. So you may have to, like, I remember when LBJ was doing Model Cities, the argument was you couldn't just attack the slums in the city on one dimension. You needed all dimensions to make it happen, education, social, housing, et cetera. It never quite worked out that way. But I think what we have to do now is start attacking each one of these things. We are doing things on education, media. There are media outlets that are trying to do this. That ProPublica site is made up of a lot of print journalists online doing exposures, winning awards for it. And we have to be able to know those things to feel good. I mean, maybe there's a level of pessimism that has penetrated the country. I just tend to be an optimistic person in my own right. And until you feel the possibility of change, then it becomes harder to do. Everyone's doing it in their little places, but we need a sense of knowing that it's connected to really make a change.
But talk about laissez-faire. I mean, in meta terms, maybe the field was more open then. Jerry's suggesting kind of structural impediments that have become to calcify around these things, around the economy and politics and education. Yes, FDR said, made by men, changed by men, but what if impediments have grown up to that? Do we have a more cluttered field in the way of change today than TR had?
I definitely think we need structural changes. I mean, we have to figure out the redistricting by commissions and not by partisans so that they can create those districts that don't need to have anybody moderate because they just speak to one side or another. Maybe the whole primary system has to be changed. Interestingly, it came into being at the turn of the 20th century in order to free the public from the public bosses who controlled the conventions. But now, given the primaries and the way they work and the activists who come to them, we don't get the moderate person who comes through the primary system oftentimes. And we've got to figure out public financing, even though we've done it before and it hasn't worked. There are answers to these things, but you need a concerted group of people working on them at the same time and feeling like, I've got comrades out there, I'm working with them, because otherwise you feel you're making a channel in one direction, but then it doesn't fit the other direction.
I wonder about how bifurcated the impulse to reform is these days. I mean, you've got your progressive left impulse to reform, but there's also, look at the Tea Party, a very strong push from the right, and no, I don't think there's a shared sense even of what direction progress points anymore exactly. Listen back to this. This was just a couple of years ago. Here's Glenn Beck, conservative television radio host. And, of course, he just can't stand Teddy Roosevelt. He can't stand Woodrow Wilson, who followed him. Here was Teddy, big Republican, in the White House. But listen to Glenn Beck pointing back, saying, that's where it all went wrong.
The original progressive politician, bingo, Teddy Roosevelt. The man who paved the way. Not much difference between Theodore Roosevelt and Wilson and FDR. Just packaged differently.
paved the way. And he means kind of paved the way to hell there. What about this sort of national sense of which way progress lies?
And indeed, the big argument that was at the turn of the century was, what is the role of government? And that was still at issue then. That is the argument today.
True.
And when you think
yeah.
about what splits the Tea Party and the left, it is in part, what should the role of government be? And it's a big debate that we need to have. I mean, and we need to have it, though, not in the virulent terms we're having it. Obviously, sometimes government's gotten over-bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. It's gotten too big in some ways. But what government means is the people having some say about what's happening to them in their lives in the country. And it's us. Government is us. But that's been lost. Government has become some abstract entity out there that seems like people can hate it. And it is hateable unless it does the right thing and does it well. But it's got to be discussed what it can and cannot do.
We've got some pushback on this image of Teddy Roosevelt as is the wonderful reformer. Here, Jeffrey says he launched his career with a call to war against Spain that would have made George W. blush. And Rolla writes, everyone loves to put the hug on Teddy, but please mention how he ruined Latin America. They hate us to this day, and for good reason.
I agree with him about Teddy's attitudes toward war. I mean, this is the side of him. All the presidents I study, there are parts that you get so disappointed in. Luckily, I'm writing about his domestic legislation mostly. But when he said things like, the victories of war are greater by far than the victories of peace, when he romanticized war, it's something that I think is a part of him that came out of being that asthmatic kid and having these heroes who were eventually cowboys, rough riders,
macho
manly
man.
Manly men. In fact, my son Joe, who went to Harvard and then went into, after 9/11, into the Army, had written his honors thesis at Harvard mm-hmm. on Teddy Roosevelt, loved him. After he came back from Afghanistan and Iraq, he said he could never understand somebody romanticizing war after he'd been in it, and he had a different feeling. So he's right. There's always aspects of these presidents. FDR incarcerated the Japanese Americans, didn't let as many Jews into the country as you would have hoped before Hitler closed the door forever, but still was the Allied leader that won the war. Teddy Roosevelt was extraordinary, what he did domestically. His attitudes toward war are beyond me. So I agree with him.
Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Karen, you're on the air. Thanks for
Hi,
calling.
Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about Roosevelt's personal magnetism and the long-term effects of that. In 1899, my grandma came with a third-grade education from Sweden. Hmm. She got a job in St. Louis working for a wealthy banker as a cook. One Sunday afternoon, President Theodore Roosevelt came to dinner at the Fergusons. My grandma got to cook dinner for him. When the dinner was over, he burst into the kitchen and said, "Where's that little girl that cooked these delicious fried chickens?" My grandmother became a progressive. She followed him. She followed Franklin Roosevelt. She brought soup to the neighbors all through the Depression. And that story has influenced me, as my grandma did. I now take my grandchildren knocking on doors with me, and I cannot say enough for the power of personal contact with President Roosevelt, who thought that little girl was an important person.
Oh, my gosh, what an amazing story. Karen, you put a tear in my eye. My great-grandmother must have been on the same ship as yours from Sweden, did her time as a cooking servant as well. Typical, this story, coming into the kitchen?
Without a question. When he'd be on the train, he'd go in to talk to the conductors, to the firemen. When he was on that train, he would stay, instead of going to lunch, to wave to people who had come to village crossings. There's one time when he's waving frantically at a group of people, and he said, "I met a rather cold and indifferent reception," until he realized it was a herd of cows that he was waving at.
But adjust those spectacles, President
she's
Roosevelt.
So right. I mean, he loved people. I mean, that's the important thing. Mm. If you're in politics, and sometimes people go into public life and they don't really love that contact with the people, he did. And I think people felt it, and that is magnetism, and that's a mystery, and it's a source of power, and a source of power for good, if it means, as she did, that it made the people that were in her family believe in his values and then want to do what he was doing. That's a great story.
Let us give you an impossible exercise, but you're the great historian, and you have such a good narrative sense. I mean, maybe Spielberg would play with this one day, but bring Teddy into our time. Have him spend a year to look around and take it on board. Imagine his response, or even a working plan that he might come up with now.
I think he would still argue that inequality is a real damaging thing to the country.
Even though, as conservatives point out, a lot of the poor today may have their television and their washing machine that they didn't have 100 years ago.
Because I think what he would argue is that what's important is not the things that surround you, but Do you have talents? Do you have possibilities that are not being exercised because you've grown up in a culture, perhaps, mm-hmm. of poverty, and your education hasn't allowed those talents to be realized? That's what Lincoln believed, too, mm-hmm. that the most important thing about our society was allowing people. He said nothing was sadder than to think that somebody had talent that they never realized because of that inequality of opportunity. I think he'd be very worried, Teddy would, today, about the lack of mobility. We've been showing in recent decades that if you're born poor, you're more likely to stay there, mm-hmm. even then. Than we had before. And he would be pretty good in the modern age of Twitter. The only problem, because he could have his little shorthand
yes,
things,
yes.
right? The problem would be he sometimes was fiery in his speech, and he might say some things he's going to have to say, uh-oh, he shouldn't have put that into the tweet. But I can see him still fighting that what our country specially represents is equality of opportunity and fairness, and we're not doing it today.
We just got half a minute. It must be frustrating for a president like President Obama to think of that pulpit, that podium that he has at his disposal, and at least so far his inability to turn it into that prow of change.
And I know he actually went to Kansas, where Teddy Roosevelt gave his famous speech in 1910, the New yes. Nationalism speech, in part to argue the same thing, that fairness is where we are today. I think he understands the actual central argument that Teddy was making and has made it, and at times has pulled through. And then the next thing you know, some other things, Syria, Benghazi, mm-hmm. Iran. The world is so much more complicated today than it was at his time.
Something for the president, something for our political leaders, really a story for all of us to meditate on, one of those moments of transformative change in American history. Doris Kearns Goodwin tells the story brilliantly, as usual, in The Bully Pulpit. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris, happy Thanksgiving. Thanks
Same
so much
to
for
you.
Coming.
Thank you for having me. Wow.
Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This is On Point. ¶¶